This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest today on the Afternoon Magazine is the founder of Teach for America, Wendy Kopp. Since its inception a little more than a decade ago, this National Service Corps has sent more than 5,000 teachers into the nation's neediest urban and rural public schools. Kopp's vision, the vision of Teach for America, is that one day all the nation's children will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education. Wendy Kopp has written a book about her experience with Teach for America. Its title is One Day, All Children, The Unlikely Triumph of Teach for America and What I Learned Along the Way. Listeners, I invite you to join us with your questions and comments this afternoon. I look forward to hearing from you. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Wendy Kopp's book, One Day All Children, is published by Public Affairs Books. And again, those telephone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Wendy Kopp, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure, my pleasure. Well, what's your background? Tell us something about yourself.
Well, I guess probably the most relevant piece of information for this purpose is that when I was a college senior at Princeton, I basically just thought of this idea for a national teacher corps. I was a member of what you may remember people were calling the me generation, theoretically. Mm-hmm. We were all just interested in making lots of money and working for investment banks and management consulting firms, and yet I found myself, and I had a sense that there were thousands of others who were just searching for something else and some way to assume a significant responsibility that would make a real difference in the world. And I had been very focused on issues of education reform and such as a public policy major, and just one day thought, you know, why doesn't this country have a national teacher corps that recruits some of its most outstanding graduating college seniors, people of all academic majors who weren't necessarily going to go into teaching, and ask them to commit 2 years to teach in urban and rural public schools.
Yeah.
So that's how I got into this.
Yeah. What kind of elementary and secondary schools did you attend?
I grew up in Dallas, Texas, and I went to a very good, you know, public school system, a very well-financed public school system. And in fact, just felt as if I had had an incredible opportunity and you know, to attain an excellent education. And it was really when I got to Princeton that I started recognizing, I mean, of all places, and I know how crazy this sounds, but that I started recognizing just how the disparities, I guess, that existed in how well-prepared people were to do well at Princeton. And honestly, I was probably about in the middle. You know, there are the people who go to the East Coast prep schools who were just breezing through Princeton like it was absolutely nothing. I felt as if I was solidly prepared. And then there were others like, you know, my roommate freshman year in college who is absolutely brilliant and yet struggled at first to meet the academic demands of Princeton because her public school in the South Bronx hadn't given her all of the skills that she needed. And I guess, you know, that's what got me really thinking about the fact that, you know, do we really in this country truly afford everyone an equal chance in life? And I think we have to, and I don't think we do yet.
Mm. You see this as a really important civil rights issue.
I really do.
Yeah. Were civil rights and other social justice issues talked about or acted on in your family growing up?
I would not necessarily. I mean, my parents are certainly, I mean, I grew up in a family of very strong values and such. My parents were small business people, you know. I don't know that there was really an ethic around community service and such, actually. And I wouldn't say that our school was particularly good at fostering that kind of a sense, actually.
Mm. So it was really at Princeton in college that you mm-hmm. kind of blossomed that way. Who was the first person you told about your idea for Teach for America? Then at that point it didn't have a name, but
right. You know, I actually had, you know, just as a college student, organized a conference about education reform, and it was there. There were students from all over the country at this conference, and we were thinking of how could we improve the education system. And there, all of these students started saying, you know, I would teach in an urban or rural area if I was called upon to do that. And it was really there that I thought, gosh, you know, why don't we have like a teacher corps, like the Peace Corps, but for teachers in the U.S.? Because these students were some of the, you know, highest achieving college students in the country. I figured most people would not believe that these people were saying that they would jump at the chance to teach in our lowest income communities. So I threw it out to the students at that conference, and you know, they didn't become quite as obsessed with it as I did. I mean, the minute I thought of it, I was just like, this is incredibly powerful, you know. And people were like, okay, that's an interesting idea. But I just felt so sure that, you know, on the one hand, these people would have a huge immediate impact during their 2 years, and that at the same time, this experience would deeply influence them, so that as they, some of them went on to careers in education and others entered other sectors, they would just take with them a rare understanding, really, of what needs to change to really ensure that all kids in this country do have an excellent education. I thought the country would ultimately be different because of that.
Yeah. The vision, the mission of Teach for America, one day all children will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education. How far off is that one day?
You know, as we speak, 9-year-olds who are growing up in low-income communities are already 3 to 4 grade levels behind 9-year-olds in high-income communities in reading ability. When you think about that, and that gap just gets wider from there to the point that, you know, kids in low-income communities are literally 7 times less likely to graduate from college than kids in high-income communities. And those gaps are every bit as wide today as they were really a decade ago when we set out in this. And so I think we're far from that day, and yet I guess what I've come to really believe over the last, 10 or 12 years now that I've been in this is that those disparities don't need to be that way. I've really come out of this with a huge sense of possibility that we can attain this vision that, you know, unites everyone who's a part of Teach for America.
Mm. Alongside Teach for America, what do you think we should be doing to move us toward that goal of one day all children?
And I would certainly never argue. I mean, I really view Teach for America as, you know, a movement. Like, we're trying to create a groundswell of support and build a leadership force in this country who are committed to this vision. So we really view this as a catalytic force and not as, in and of itself, the systemic solution, you know. I guess what I've come out of this thinking is, first of all, you can't do what we do without really believing that we have to commit ourselves to affecting the broader systemic changes outside of education to take the pressure off of schools, you know, improve local economies in urban and rural areas, and strengthen the quality of public health care and social services, and ensure that kids have access to quality daycare or preschool programs in urban and rural areas, because what we're expecting schools to compensate for is truly, truly overwhelming. And yet at the same time, I've also really come to believe that as long as the socioeconomic circumstances that exist today persist, that it is absolutely within our reach to build a school system that puts kids growing up in under-resourced areas on a level playing field with kids in other areas. And I could talk more about what I think that would take.
What would that take?
You know, I guess I think 3 things. First, I think we have to make the commitment to this big idea, you know, to this idea that all kids in our country should have the chance to attain an excellent education. And I guess I'm not totally convinced that in our communities and in our country we've truly committed ourselves to that, said, you know, we want all of our kids to be on grade level, and then step back and said, okay, now what would it take to get there? So that's the first thing I think we need to do. And I've just seen through the last 12 years in so many different ways that when you commit to a big idea, it just unleashes new ideas and new energy, and solutions become, you know, clear that you never thought would be possible. So that's the first thing. The second thing I think is that We need to complement the commitment to the big idea with the recognition that the key to getting there is to essentially engage in the hard work of institution building that accounts for success in any sector. Meaning, you know, I think in education we tend to lurch from one sort of strategy to another. Like this year it's smaller class size, and then it's technology and education, or maybe it's this curricular reform. And yet in any sector, what accounts for success is organizations building the capacity to achieve results over time. And I've learned so much in just the process of building Teach for America about what that means. You know, that means you've got to put tremendous amounts of energy into recruiting and developing talented people at every level. It means building strong cultures and systems for accountability and continuous improvement. And I think in the end that we need to take just a long-term institution-building approach to our schools and school districts. And that in the end, I mean, the good news is that there's nothing mysterious or elusive about making schools work. The bad news is that there's just no way around the hard work that it takes to achieve success in any sector. And then the third thing, just quickly, is that I don't think we'll reach this big idea unless we invest disproportionately in schools in our lowest income communities, because you know, kids in these communities face challenges that kids in other communities simply don't face, and it just follows that equal resources is not going to generate equal outcomes.
That's a real tough nut to crack, though, isn't it? Because what I hear people say is, you know, yeah, that's a great idea in terms of getting all kids on the same level and that kind of thing. But they see it as, well, you don't take stuff away from my school, you know?
Yeah. And it's too bad that we think it has to be, I guess, a zero-sum game. I mean, I think that as a country, it's on all of us to ensure that all of our kids have a chance to attain an excellent education. And I think that means that ultimately we're going to have to say we've got to invest more in schools in our low-income communities. And I don't think that should take away from what we're investing in other communities. And certainly, you know, that means an investment of more resources, but I just don't know how else we're going to get where we need to be.
Wendy Kopp is our guest this afternoon. She is the founder of Teach for America. She's written a book about Teach for America and her experiences with the organization. It is titled One Day All Children, The Unlikely Triumph of Teach for America and What I Learned Along the Way. Listeners, your comments and questions are welcome in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk a little bit about how Teach for America works. It's a 2-year commitment. Why 2 years?
You know, really for probably numerous reasons. I mean, the first of which is that when you're a college senior, you're basically evaluating, and you have lots of other options. You're thinking about lots of 2-year options, lots of different corporate training programs, different graduate schools and such. And so just to be competitive with the other opportunities that are in front of college seniors who do have a lot of other options. And also I think, you know, I think that as long as the disparities that exist in our country in education persist, that we need a force in this country that is producing leadership that will ultimately work in many different sectors in education, and many of our people decide to stay in education, but also in other sectors who have an understanding of both the realities facing kids in low-income communities and of what the solutions are. Because ultimately it's going to take much more than leadership within education. You know, we need people at every level of policy and in every sector who are committed to this and who have the insight necessary to take us where we need to go.
And alumni of Teach for America, give us some idea of what they're up to.
We have 6,000 Teach for America alumni, and we, I guess, placed our first core member 11 years ago now. And of our alums, 60% are actually still working full-time in education, 40% are teaching, another 20% are in school leadership positions. And even of the 40% who leave education, 70% have jobs that relate in some way to schools or low-income communities. So maybe they're lawyers, but they're practicing education law, or they're doctors working in urban areas. And I think beyond just the fact that they're still engaged in these issues, the thing that's so inspiring to me to see is the degree to which they're already assuming significant leadership roles in this broader effort to improve education and improve the quality of life in low-income communities. They're running some of the most nationally acclaimed charter schools in the country. They're turning around major urban public schools. Just looking at Washington, D.C. alone, we have a school board member with the D.C. Public Schools. Our alums are running various divisions in the district. Someone is the mayor's advisor for education. Another woman is the White House fellow working with Rod Paige on national education policy. So they're really, everywhere you look in education reform, particularly as it relates to low-income communities, you'll see Teach for America alumni.
Who is Teach for America material?
We're looking for people who demonstrate the kind of achievement orientation and critical thinking skills that account for success really in any sector. And we're looking for people who demonstrate that in their past, since we think that that's the best indication, you know, that someone will be successful in the future. So I would say we're looking for leadership skills, and of course we're looking for a real passion for and a commitment to the vision of Teach for America. You know, we're looking for people who want to do this because they believe that it's outrageous that we have the inequities that we do in this country, and who want to do something about that.
Early on, a superintendent in a large urban district told you in no uncertain way that he didn't need you or any do-gooder teachers. And another person told you a 2-year commitment wasn't enough. How did those concerns affect you at the time? And what about this idea of, you know, to want to do something good is one thing, but to be able to deliver is something entirely different.
Well, I guess certainly, I mean, there have been sort of along the way, you know, and as with anything new and anything that's trying to affect broader change, I'll run into people and have discussions that are very difficult, and certainly I've learned a lot from these discussions. But what kept me going is the fact that there's such tremendous support for Teach for America, particularly in the communities where we work. And in fact, school principals and other teachers in the schools where we are and school district administrators feel so strongly about the value that Teach for America brings to their schools, both in terms of the commitment and energy and just talent that the core members bring during their 2 years and in terms of what they see our alumni going on to do. And so I guess that's really what has kept us going. And you know, in terms of, I think you asked about, like, what about, I mean, of course, you have to actually be able to have an impact. And mm-hmm. and that's I mean, I guess just the fact that our core members do have a significant impact and that in the eyes of their principals, they're extremely effective teachers, is just the best evidence, obviously, that this works and has obviously been instrumental in just building support for the program.
Yeah, and you really want good people who are going to be good teachers. Maybe you would tell us about the interview questions you had for potential recruits at the outset of,
right.
of Teach for America.
Well, just to give your listeners a little sense, basically, but then I want to answer the substance of your question. In this first year of Teach for America, I mean, here I was a college senior. I needed a thesis topic and proposed the creation of this in my thesis. And then was so determined that it had to happen and secured a seed grant to start it and then pulled together a group of other recent graduates to get it off the ground. And we launched a grassroots recruitment campaign at 100 schools across the country, and 2,500 people responded within just 4 months. So we were then faced with the challenge of how do we interview these people and what are the criteria to select them? And really from the start, we were looking for people who demonstrate just strong leadership and critical thinking skills. And one of our staff members developed these selection criteria, which were extremely rigorous. You're probably referring to this question, which I won't remember the whole question now, but it started with, what is wind? And asked people to describe wind, which I would be hard-pressed to do even now. I think the impact of that interview, though, just as we had hoped, was to build around Teach for America an aura of selectivity and status. And we knew that we had to do that because, in part to counter the unfortunate perception of teaching as something that doesn't attract people who are academically able. And the word got out within literally days about this interview that was just so challenging. I mean, I think over time we've refined our criteria a great deal, and not just our criteria. I mean, our criteria have stayed somewhat similar to what they were initially, but really our approach to getting at them. Selection is so difficult, and I think we've gotten better at that over time.
I've got the book open to that place in the story, and I really want to share this with the listeners because it's really something. What is wind? Don't describe it. Just tell me what it is. And then the follow-up question is, phenomenologists draw an analogy between religion and the wind, claiming that one can't see religion, only the manifestations of it, like synagogues, churches, and mosques. Similarly, one can't see the wind, only manifestations of it, waves in a wheat field, moving branches. What's another analogy you can draw to the wind? It's a good stretching exercise, isn't it?
Yeah.
What kind of recruitment efforts do you make today? Where do you go, and how often?
Well, we recruit very aggressively, and we recruit actively at about 120 campuses and have information at hundreds more than that. Anyone can apply as long as they have a BA degree, but we really do a lot of outreach at certain campuses just because we have limited resources. But this year 5,000 people applied to Teach for America, and we had 1,000 teaching positions. You know, that generated 1,000 people who met our criteria. And we're working to double in size over the next 3 years. And so we're working to generate, by 3 years from now, 10,000 applicants. So you can imagine that this is a challenge that keeps us up at night, and so we're taking our recruitment effort constantly to a higher and higher level.
Mm. Schools all over the country are facing teacher shortages. Teachers are retiring. Fewer young people seem to be interested at the moment in going into the field as a career. Has that affected you? Although, you know, you got another great crop again this year, but I'm wondering if you feel it at all.
We certainly see the shortage impacting the school districts that we work with, and clearly, I mean, we don't view ourselves as the answer to the teacher shortage. We really view ourselves in the context of this achievement gap that exists out there, and we're trying to provide teachers who will go far above and beyond traditional expectations to help to ensure that their students, students growing up today in low-income communities, have the opportunities they deserve. And at the same time, we're working to build this leadership force of people who are continuing to work toward this larger vision and to work to affect the broader systemic changes that are necessary. That being said, I mean, certainly one of the systemic changes I've come to believe needs to happen is that our school systems are, I think, just going to need to invest more in the recruitment and development of talented staff at every level. And we've certainly learned a lot about how to recruit and select and train and support new teachers. And a group of our alumni have actually launched a new organization called the New Teacher Project to help school districts develop that capacity. And I would say that organization is really doing probably more than Teach for America to really, really address the teacher shortage and try to help districts attract the number of people that they need.
Mm. Can you give us some idea of where you've placed teachers?
Absolutely. We really place our core members in some of the most under-resourced and hardest to staff communities in the country, from remote rural areas in the Mississippi Delta and southern Louisiana, eastern North Carolina, to urban areas, actually in Chicago, where we're placing this year for our first year, to New York City, to, you know, where we're in the Bronx and Harlem and Washington Heights, South Central Los Angeles, and such.
And in the Midwest, any rural communities?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with this person on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I would like to address a question or possibly just a point of view to your guest. Would she like to comment on all works such as, what's the name of the book, Education, Smoking Gun, which came out about 10 or 15 years ago, in the Educational Wastelands, which is a classic, in terms of the perspective of the teachers' colleges, the entire teacher certification process, that we actually tend to get some of the least qualified intellectually, least qualified people intellectually to teach?
Well, as you know, there's such a movement to increase the standards of schools of education and strengthen schools of education, and I think that obviously that movement is great. At the same time, I think that we'll never get where we need to be unless school systems do what successful organizations in any sector do, which is go out and aggressively recruit people, really from all walks of life. I think they should recruit at schools of education, and as long as they need to look elsewhere in order to find enough people who meet their standards, I think they should go beyond that. I think they should recruit young professionals and mid-career professionals and retired professionals in some cases, who have the leadership characteristics necessary to be great teachers. And then I think at the district level, we need to invest in training and supporting teachers and developing some of them into leadership roles as well.
Okay. Well, so do you believe that we do need education courses per se, that it should be a process that takes 2 years of primarily education courses?
Teach for America is obviously doing it in a different way, and it's
right.
Working for us. You know, we do believe, I mean, clearly we have found there to be a tremendously, I mean, it's very, very difficult to teach, and particularly to teach effectively in low-income communities, and we think there's a real knowledge base to being an effective teacher. Our model is to, first of all, select people according to very rigorous standards, and then provide them with an intensive pre-service program that's 5 weeks long, where they gain teaching experience in a summer school, and then are also just immersed in both the overarching approach that differentiates the most successful teachers, as well as just gaining the basic teaching skills that they need. You know, how do you assess students? How do you design effective lesson plans and such? And then we cluster our people in schools and develop an ongoing support network for them so that they are stepping back constantly and reflecting on their experience, and so that they're able to access a whole host of additional resources as they encounter new challenges in their teaching situation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We have another listener waiting to talk with us on line two in Urbana. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm having a hard time hearing you. Can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay, fine. I hope you don't feel slighted by what I'm about to say. I'm actually hoping to do a tour starting in the spring with the Peace Corps. But mm-hmm. if things don't work out with them, you know, if they don't have any need for my peculiar skills anywhere
uh-huh.
in the world, Teach for America is second on my list.
Good.
And I was also curious to know if, by any chance, is there a sister organization of yours or anything like your organization in Canada?
You know, not to my knowledge, but that doesn't mean anything. I've never encountered an organization like this in Canada.
I would think you would have found each other by now.
Yeah.
Is there any prospect that you will be having, what do you call them, missions or assignments?
Oh, core members? Or
where you actually go and teach. What do you call that?
Sites, geographic areas.
A site.
Yeah.
In the north and west.
We place in the Bay Area. You mean further north and west than that?
Yeah, you know, like Utah or Idaho or Montana or...
It's possible. We may, and, you know, I know as we grow, we're looking at a few sites, one of which is Seattle, another, you know, we're looking at Indian reservations in the Dakotas, potentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would prefer rural areas myself versus the urban, but... well, anyway, I will be in touch with you if things don't work out.
Great, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Questions and comments are welcome. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is the founder of Teach for America, Wendy Kopp. Since its inception more than a decade ago, 11, 12 years ago, this National Service Corps has sent more than 5,000 teachers into the nation's neediest urban and rural public schools. Wendy Kopp is the author of One Day, All Children, The Unlikely Triumph of Teach for America, and What I Learned Along the Way. Wendy, when you started out, you estimated you would need $2.5 million to launch the Service Corps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're 21 years old. were you at all concerned about trying to raise that sum?
I certainly should have been. You know, yes, I think I certainly recognized that it would be a challenging thing. I though, had this incredible advantage at the time, which was a very, very high level of naivete. And I was just convinced that this was an idea that simply had to happen. I knew the timing was perfect because national corporations and foundations had said that they wanted to support national education reform initiatives. And so I was just convinced that this would work out. And you know, I got that initial seed grant. I mean, literally 2 days before I graduated from college after, you know, writing 30 letters to 30 randomly selected corporate executives. And that enabled me, that gave me a measure of credibility. And as I went around and talked with other funders, what I heard from them was that they thought it was a great idea, but they thought the college students would never do it. And that was the one thing that I had total confidence in, because having just been a college senior, I was just sure that people would jump at this. And so the plan became, I mean, thank heaven I didn't know then what I know now, but the plan became to show all these people that the college students wanted to do it, with the theory being that then the funding would come together. And sure enough, that it did work out. I read once that when an idea is meant to happen, the laws of the universe are suspended to make way for it, and it's really the only explanation I've ever found for the fact that this did all work out and that we were able to find that funding in year one.
Yeah. Tell us about your meeting with Ross Perot.
Well, you know, I as I said before, I had proposed this in the creation of a teacher corps in my thesis, and my thesis advisor calls me into his office and says, where in the world are you going to find $2.5 million? And I said, you know, I don't know, but I think Ross Perot would love this idea because he's from Dallas and I'm from Dallas and he's really into education reform. And so I wrote him a letter. And in fact, I wrote him many letters over the coming few months. And sure enough, in April of, you know, the year after I graduated, I got a phone call. And I thought it was a friend of mine because everyone knew I was trying to get in touch with Ross Perot. So I get on the phone, and sure enough, it's Ross Perot. And I say, I'm coming to Dallas. Can I meet with you? I mean, at this point, we had 500 core members, and we had virtually no money. So I thought, this is my answer. And I literally formed a mental image in my head of being glued to his chair until I got a commitment for $1 million. And sure enough, I mean, I was in his office for a long time, and he kept saying, you know, as anyone, you know, I think who's a philanthropist tends to do, you know, Sam Walton would love this. Every other philanthropist would love this. And I kept saying, yeah, but you're the one who really will love it most. And you have to be my answer. And finally, he committed to make a challenge grant of $500,000, which I then matched I needed to match 3-1. But that was really what we needed to catalyze the support of the other people who I'd met.
Interesting. Let's talk with another listener. On line one, a caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
I want to thank your guests for all of her efforts. And I had a question. I was going to go to ISU to finish my degree as an English major with a secondary education certificate. And I was wondering, is there some program where it would help out financially with schooling for people who committed to work in certain needy areas?
Mm-hmm. Well, Teach for America, I know, is part of AmeriCorps, and so our Corps members get these education awards of $4,750 at the end of each year of service that they can apply toward past or future educational expenses. I think that there may be other programs, and it probably also depends on the district and the state in which you teach, that enable people who teach in high-need areas to attain loan forgiveness and that kind of thing.
Is there how could I reach you to find out more information about all this?
You could go to our website at teachforamerica.org, www.teachforamerica.org.
All right, thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana on line 2. Hi.
Yeah, I keep thinking as you're talking that you're from an Ivy League school. You only recruit people who have degrees, despite the fact that you think people in all walks of life should be teaching. And I'm just wondering, isn't this, it comes off to me at least, that you're kind of a little bit too much, in, for my taste anyway, in the corner of favoring or looking upon academic achievement as the proper arbiter of social and economic success. And I'm just curious what you would say to that. It seems you don't have, you're essentially, since you haven't said a word about it, you accept the current curriculum, for example. You don't seem to think that there might be a mismatch between what is really achievable for a lot of kids from low-resource schools. And could you talk about that a bit?
So you're saying that do we believe that academic achievement of say, kids who are growing up in low-income areas is the sort of key to them being on sort of a level playing field with kids in other areas?
Well, I'm saying that you don't seem to realize that this brings up another question. I wonder if you yourself have taught in some low-resource schools because, you know, you come upon kids who would be perfectly happy working with their hands, for example, or maybe being gardeners.
And I guess what we would say is absolutely, but in no greater proportion than you would find those people in a very wealthy area. And we just think that regardless of where someone happens to be born, that they deserve an equal chance in life, and they deserve to have the chance to make their own choices, which means, you know, having the option of going to college if that's what they choose.
Right, but that does not address the real needs and of those kids. Let's take your proposition as fact that the proportion of kids who would want to be construction workers is the same in an upper socioeconomic group as in a lower. Mm-hmm. Let's say that's true. You're still, you know, by this emphasis on academic achievement, especially in the current curriculum, we're going to devote all of our schooling to giving them a chance to be successful in this one particular sector and totally neglect everything else.
But what we're saying is that, you know, it is a tragedy that we are graduating kids from high school. First of all, you know, an astronomical portion of kids in low-income areas don't even graduate from high school. You know, in some cases, 50 and 60% of kids. But those who do graduate, many of them are reading at no more than a middle school level. And certainly that's not always the case. But we think that that is absolutely simply not fair to those kids. And that's what we're trying to address. I mean, that's the fundamental charge that Teach for America is working on.
Well, I keep thinking of something like for example, if this is kind of like forced, they're forced to be there. Like I might enjoy seeing a movie like Braveheart or something, and I can see myself sitting through it. But if I had to go through a chick flick every day, you know, I'd be walking out myself. You know, a large part of the reason a lot of people hate school is that they see nothing in it for themselves. And I think you really ought to devote something to that. But let me ask you another question. Bush's education plan, I was just curious if what side of the issue you were on that, because he's had one great idea which seems to have fallen on the wayside now, but he was labeling schools by its lowest achieving group. You know, they divide a school up into these groups.
Yeah.
And I think it sounds like you're aware of that, but it seems like they've dropped the idea, and that would have put a lot more resources at, exactly as you said, quite rightly, that in the low resource places.
Right.
Were you in favor of that idea, and have you done anything to, you know, push the guy into fulfilling his promise, so to speak?
You know, I'm not actually sure exactly which part of his plan you're talking about, but I certainly believe, as I said earlier, that we need to invest disproportionately in schools in our lowest income communities. And I also believe that we need to hold our schools accountable for ensuring that their kids are achieving at high levels. So there are certainly parts of the bipartisan plan that's come out of Congress that I think will take us in the right direction.
Okay, I want to thank the caller for his call this afternoon. One of the things that he asked along the way was, have you been a teacher?
And I have not. You know, as I mentioned, I started this right out of college. And as you probably know from at least hopefully reading the book, there were just tremendous challenges along the way. You know, it really started off with great momentum, and then we ran into just some really, really difficult times and some difficult challenges in keeping Teach for America alive, let alone building it into a thriving organization. And so I never felt that it would be right to leave. And now I'm still so caught up in this effort as we work to take it to an even higher level and to grow. So I haven't taught, which I think in many ways has certainly, I mean, I think if I had taught, I would, there's so many things that I could have brought much earlier to the organization. Certainly our staff, you know, is made up of mostly Teach for America alumni. So we certainly have the perspective of teachers really driving the organization at this point.
Yeah. So your mission has been in that middle area that is so hard after the big idea institution building.
Right, exactly.
Let's talk with one more listener here this afternoon before we have to wrap things up.
Hello?
On line one in Urbana, hi.
Yes, this seems a very well-intentioned and idealistic program, but I'd like your comment on something that teachers have often told me, and I know quite a few, that their first year wasn't very productive. That it takes time to learn how to teach, and even with what they had gotten from their teacher training, mm-hmm. it still was a couple of years before they became effective teachers. And your people are dropping out after 2 years.
Well, some of them are choosing to do other things and some are not. I mean, about 60% of them are teaching beyond their 2 years. But I guess what I hear from them is, first of all, as you say, teaching is enormously challenging, and all of them, I mean, so many of them say that the greatest challenge of their professional lives, you know, because some of them have now had their first year 11 years ago, but was that first year of teaching. At the same time, though, I haven't heard them say that it wasn't productive. In fact, They feel as if they do make a significant impact during their first year. It's just that it's a tremendous amount of work and a tremendous learning curve that they go through to get there. But, I mean, I just came back from our pre-service training institute in Houston where some of our core members are in training, close to about 650 of them right now. And, you know, the charge to them is not to simply survive, but to effect dramatic gains in student achievement in their first and second years as teachers. And we're working to train them so that they're well prepared to do that and then to support them in the effort.
Okay. Well, there we have to leave it because we're out of time. Wendy, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
For talking with us this afternoon. Good luck.
Thanks.
Wendy Kopp has been our guest this afternoon. She's the founder of Teach for America. Since its inception 11, 12 years ago, the Service Corps has sent more than 5,000 teachers into the nation's neediest public schools. Her vision and the vision of Teach for America is that one day all the nation's children will have the opportunity to attain an excellent education. She is the author of One Day All Children, The Unlikely Triumph of Teach for America, and What I Learned Along the Way. The book is published by Public Affairs Books.